Welcome to episode 128 of the Horror Podcast. My name is Tyler Unsel, and by day, I'm just an ordinary teacher. But by night, I transform into an ordinary teacher who likes to talk about spooky shit. And I am joined tonight, as I am by most nights, by the co-hostess with the mostest, the sleekest skeleton I know, Oren Gray. Oren, what's going on, man? What have you been up to?
What's going? I have mostly been working, as usual. Although we are getting into Halloween season, so I did decorate finally. I think it's the latest I've ever decorated, but I finally got decorated like a week ago.
So does Castle Grayskull go like, you know, all out for Halloween?
We live in a townhouse, so I can't get like super all out because, I mean, where am I going to put it? Like, I don't have a yard. But you know, I put up pumpkins on the front porch and, you know, I put up stuff all through the house more so. I mean, there's like shit. There's a banner. Anybody who's followed my Instagram, like there's a banner that hangs above my TV all year round. That's a Halloween banner that says spooky. Like it's always there.
I love it. That is, the podcast studio is where all of my spooky shit gets banished to like 11 months out of the year. And then that one month it explodes out, you know, like Nosferatu waking up or something. So yeah, we're in the midst of the office exploding out, but yeah, that's the fun time of the season, right?
Yeah.
Well, tonight we're going to discuss what we've been reading and watching. We're going to highlight some free content on the internet with our dark corner of the web. And then finally, we're going to travel to Italy by way of Seattle with James Wan's newest giallo tribute, Malignant, and I think we are both super stoked to talk about that.
I'm very excited to talk about Malignant.
But before we get there, what have you been reading? What have you been watching? What's going on with you when it comes to consuming content?
I've been watching a lot of, you know, random old shit, as I usually am. A lot of it I'm reviewing on Signal Horizon, so you'll be able to read about it there. A bunch of giallo stuff, actually. I just did the Sergio Martino triple feature thing from Arrow, which will be up on Signal soon, and you know, just lots of that stuff. What I've been reading these Crestwood House monster books.
That's nuts. Where'd you find those?
So I found these, I couldn't remember if I talked about this last time or not. I found these at an antique mall out in like Independence, and I found like seven of them, and that's wild because they're like super hard to find. And so I read them when I was a kid. All my school libraries had them. As near as I can tell, they were like library exclusives. I've never seen one without a library stamp, but they were like, you know, I read the shit out of them when I was a kid. They were huge for me. And so I found these. I found these and I bought them. And so I'm going to read them all and then like write about each one a week until Halloween. I started this last week. I'm gonna do one a week to Halloween since there's seven.
I love it. Yeah. Were they reasonably priced?
Yeah, they were like $5 a piece.
Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, I think you and I have talked about this since my very first interview with you, but those Crestwood books were in both my public library, but also my school library, and very much so those books, and then a series that were very similar to them that were about like either cryptids or like UFOs. There was one about I mean they were so informative to the spooky curious little kid that I was that I can't not look at those things and just be taken back to Union Chapel Elementary School, you know, like this is the best time ever.
Yeah, and like I love that their branding is just like the same for every book, so that like they're very distinct. Like you can just look, you can tell from across a room, you can spot one.
Yeah, right, exactly. You're like, what is that? Yeah, but here is the weird thing, you know, like I forget the term for it, but it's like it's Bernstein Bears, not Berenstein Bears, and it's
Mandela effect.
Yes, that's it, right? Yeah. I remember them being orange though, and not blue.
Okay, there's two series. That's okay. The thing. There's an orange series. The orange series was first. The orange series came out in the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay.
And then the blue series, or the purple series, came out in the mid 80s.
Okay.
And so, like, the orange series are hard. I mean, they're easier to find. You can find more stuff about them, but they're very expensive because they're the more desirable ones. They covered the, like, the big movies. So like they're Frankenstein, Dracula,
yep.
Kind of stuff, Godzilla. And these are like weird B-side movies. So I've got like Ghost of Frankenstein here and like Revenge of the Creature and like Dracula's Daughter and shit like that.
Nice. Well, I think the very first book I ever checked out was Bride of Frankenstein. And I think that was one of the original run.
Yeah.
And it essentially what made those books so great is they had so many of these film stills and, you know, that kind of, and it was just, what a wonderful adventure as you kind of fly through all of this. So, very good. I have nothing, nearly that cool. What I have been reading and watching, first off, Dread Distribution has a new movie out that we actually reviewed as part of Phoenix FearCon like a year and a half ago, but I revisited it last week. It's called Bad Candy. It is a Halloween anthology. It's really, really fun. It's got a ton of practical effects. I had a great time watching it. I will go ahead and make the claim. It has a few like kind of special effects that will probably not age super well, but the CG in Bad Candy, I think might actually be a little better than the CG in Malignant, just because it's used so sparingly and not for giant, huge scenes, you know, kind of like,
giant, huge scenes.
Right, right. Like, you know, a Keanu Reeves Matrix-esque, you know, final battle, which
where she kills like 30,000 cops. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All back. Yeah. 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 All
backward.
Right. 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 And not to get the cart ahead of the horse, but through that entire scene, I was reminded of, the famous quote about Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, right? That she did everything he did only backwards and in heels.
Right. I'm really curious and I'm very like, so again, we're getting ahead of ourselves a bit, but James Wan movies tend to not have a lot of like behind the scenes stuff when they release on Blu-ray, which is kind of a disappointment for me usually. But I'm really looking forward to learning more about how Malignant was made because I'm really curious how much of the stuff with the killer being backward is CG and how much is weird practical effects, whether that's you know, people who are double jointed or. I mean, like a lot of that John Wick sequence is definitely CG. Like that's even if it was forward, it would be CG. Like that's the kind of stuff that we don't do practically anymore if we ever did. But like a lot of the other scenes, I think they probably use more practical stuff than it looks like. And I'm curious to see where the lines are there.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. Like they're the chase scene, right? Where you know, we're kind of following the monster into the lower half of Seattle or whatever. Yeah, I felt like they got the guy that kind of, he's got a really common name that I'm blanking on right now, but the guy that does all that double jointed, like weird twisty shit. I think his name's Twisty something, like Twisty Ted or Twisty, I don't fucking know. I don't, it's been a long week.
And you're probably thinking of Javier Botet, but that's not a common name.
yeah, I'm gonna say that guy. Yeah, but we're gonna get there in just a second. I did want to give a shout out. I am maybe halfway through, three-fourths of the way through Nick Cutter's book Little Heaven, which has surprisingly some really effective like folk horror to it, like American folk horror too. Nice. which it's kind of my jam, and I really appreciated that. It certainly feels a little more like noir-y as opposed to his other stuff, which I have really enjoyed too, but it's definitely like very strictly horror. You know, this is a little more inventive. And the last thing I want to say about what I've been reading, watching, and all that jazz, my wife and I sit down and watch Evil on Paramount Plus now. And it is very much in the vein of other kind of paranormal serials like Supernatural or Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But man, is it got some really great character creature work. It's very scary. It is that kind of pulpy, silly, great way to end an evening on. So we just like watch an episode before we go to bed. And I like, It fills my dreams full of spooky goodness. And I just, I don't know. Yeah. Nice. If you haven't checked out Evil, you really should give it a chance.
No, I have not.
It's quite good. Yeah. So our dark corner of the web, if you go to Tubi TV, which we talk about all the time on this show, they have a wonderful documentary that gives, I think, a really fantastic overview of giallo generally. And it's just full of beautiful shots that they have decided to either highlight or to kind of discuss, right? And the name of that documentary is All the Colors of Giallo. So you can check that out for free if you just navigate to Tubi TV. Because here's the bottom line. I have seen a few because, you know, like, I don't know, you're kind of obligated to see a handful of them, especially if you're in you know, the company that we mostly hang out with. But I was not well-versed. So in getting ready for this episode, I watched a lot of shit and really dove deep into it. And I think I have always said, like, I can remember talking to Greg from Nightmare Junkhead, who we both absolutely love and adore, about Suspiria, which has never been one of my favorites. And I've always said, I don't think Giallo, I think Giallo is maybe too cool for me or something. And he would always chuckle politely. But I think now that I better understand it, I kind of like it better. So,
that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So check out that documentary and then maybe revisit some of those giallo films that maybe you said you didn't like. I don't know.
Yeah. Or try one that you haven't tried, because like there is a lot of variety in it for all that it, like anything, has its formulas. I mean, there's one of the really interesting things about the Sergio Martino box set that I'm going to be talking about for Signal is that, like, so it's three movies. They're all three ostensibly giallos. They're all three by the same director. They're functionally different plot. Like, they're functionally different genres, even though they're all giallos. Like, one of them is a Hitchcockian kind of murder mystery. One is this kind of gothic Edgar Allan Poe riff. And one is, like, a caper film, almost. And they all hit all the beats of giallo technically, but they're also all very different from one another. So,
yeah, I was amazed at the variety, right? And I have kind of always thought about giallo films by my experiences with Suspiria, which were not like what I think a lot of other giallo films are. Like, I had no idea that they leaned so heavy into that kind of police narrative, you know, that on occasion, almost like a caper film or something, you know, like it has all of this.
There are a lot of people who will argue that Suspiria is not even a giallo.
Okay.
Because to them, the defining feature of the giallo, the thing it has to have, is essentially that detective story, and Suspiria doesn't have it. It has no police element. It has no, it really has very little murder mystery element. It's a supernatural film instead. I don't necessarily agree. Like I think that does a thing that I disapprove of doing generally, which is to define things by exclusion rather than inclusion.
Right.
Like, I think that Suspiria is a giallo and also other things.
That's fair. Yeah. You know, if I'm being perfectly honest, for me, when I was defining giallo or not giallo or whatever, it almost singularly came down to it came down to the color palette, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Hey, it looks like we had Krusty Antiques in here for a moment, wishing us a happy Halloween. So, hey, Krusty Antiques, welcome, and happy Halloween to you, too. So, I think now is a great time to get into it. I think we've been nibbling around the edges, but it is most definitely time to try and answer tonight's essential question, which is, does Malignant speak to anything uniquely American in its portrayal of giallo films? Let's take a look at that. Oh, hey, Hey, Krusty. Good to see you. Let's take a look at the trailer for Malignant and come back and have a go about it.
I'm having visions.
The body of Dr. Florence Weaver was found brutally murdered in her home this morning.
Did you know her?
No, but I saw her die.
I'm seeing things. I'm seeing murders. As they're happening.
Hello?
He says his name is Gabriel. I think he's someone from my past.
Happy birthday.
Whatever happened to you before you joined our family hurt you in a way that I can't even imagine.
Stop saying that.
Maddie, who are you talking to?
Gabriel.
Is he your imaginary friend? Imaginary friend?
He's the devil. Again, he's getting closer. He wants to talk to you. Mom, what do you know? He's coming for me.
All right. So before we get into any kind of discussion, we should say throughout this last kind of 30 or 40 minutes that we have here, we are going to spoil the shit out of this movie. It is available right now in movie theaters, which if you feel safe and comfortable going to see, you should absolutely do that. Support your local small theaters. If you don't, that's okay too. You can check it out on HBO Max. So let's chat. Real briefly, after we go over kind of the Internet Movie Database summary of what we're going to talk about. In the movie, Madison is paralyzed by shocking visions of grisly murders, and her torment worsens as she discovers that these waking dreams are, in fact, terrifying realities. I think it does a pretty good job of not spoiling the movie. And, yeah, you know,
I was going to say, like, I love how much the trailer is a trailer for a movie that's completely not the one you're about to watch. Like,
yeah,
it gives no indication of how just completely off the rails this movie is.
Yeah. At all.
Like it seems very much like a J horror version of The Ice of Laura Mars. It seems very like subdued by comparison to what we actually get.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and in that way, honestly, I think the movie may underplay how fun it actually is, you know? Oh, yeah. So, like, the movie really utilizes some interesting techniques, right? And some of what you see in the trailer there is this beautiful conceit where, like, the reality around her melts away, right? Like, almost physically melts away. And I think that is a brilliant way to go about showing the ultimate twist, which is, again, skip forward, go watch the movie, revisit, because I really, really don't want to spoil this movie for anybody.
Yeah, but we're going to. We can't. It is impossible to usefully talk about this movie without spoiling it. So
yeah. So long story short, Gabriel is a conjoined twin that they had removed from our main character.
Removed.
Yeah, right. when she was younger, but it was growing out of the back of her head. And so some of Gabriel, the conjoined twin, still exists in her brain and gets rewoken by her abusive husband. And then shit gets wild.
Yeah. And that's such an oversimplification of how fucking wild it actually is. Like, the explanation of what they did and how Gabriel rebuilt himself is so messed up and just, wild.
Yeah, and I don't know if I fully, like, so he was like a full-on twin with, like, arms and a face growing out of the back of her back, right?
Yeah.
And so they remove all of that, but at some point at the end of this film, she pulls her head apart.
Right.
And
well, they when they remove it, they put his face back in. Like, there's actually a shot of them, like, because they were connected at the brain, so they couldn't remove the head part. So they just put it inside her head because there's totally space in there. Incidentally.
Right.
There's room for a whole other face in the back of my brain. Absolutely. A thing that's really true.
I can't, like, that's your one beef with this movie.
Right. But no, like, there's a scene where they literally, like, push it in. It's very disturbing. And then put her head back together. And yeah, so he's, like, popping out of the back of her head after her husband cracks her skull.
The movie starts at a breakneck speed, and
I
remember complaining a lot on the last season of the Horror Podcast that I just wanted to fast burn. I just wanted, and this movie is as fast a burn as it left a burning sensation in me that lasted way too long. Right. Yeah, so
this movie starts out at a run and does not stop.
I'm like, oh shit, that guy's like slapping his wife around. That's not good. And then 10 minutes later, he's dead and shit's wild.
Right. Even before that, you get that like super like melodramatic.
Like
hospital sequence at the beginning, which also tells you, like, I mean, we've spoiled the shit at the end of the movie already, but like that first like 2 minutes tells you so much more information than the trailer gives you.
Oh yeah.
Like the trailer sets it up as it's going to be this big, like, oh, it's a mystery. What's going on? Blah, blah, blah. And the like first 2 minutes are like, oh, there's this weird monster twin that can control electricity. Here's him behind a curtain. Yeah. By the way, like in 2 minutes, it's wild. Like,
well, and it 100%, like, I think maybe, and I went back and watched it some, it's got some Dutch angles and some, and you're 100% right on the melodrama, but like, it almost makes it difficult to read the tone of the film, you know? Cause it's like, shit, am I watching like a straight up horror movie? Or is this like Gremlins 2 and everything's kind of tongue in cheek? And like, what am I getting myself in for?
Like, I've seen the screenwriter talking on a Twitter a couple of times and like suggesting that, like replying to people basically, and essentially suggesting that like to some extent it's intentionally written in cop show cliches.
Yeah.
I mean, it 100% is. Like, it 100% is written in cop show cliches. Like, there is not a word that falls out of a person's mouth in this movie that you did not hear on, like, CSI whatever.
Oh, yeah.
It's like CSI Seattle with a crazy serial killer superhero monster.
Yeah, like, it even doubles down on the dynamic between the two detectives, right? You know, the kind of wizened old, like, you know, like, I'm not going to take shit off anybody, and blah, blah, blah. And the kind of younger, more sympathetic cop. And yeah, like, yeah. Which is not what I expected. So,
yeah, everything in this movie, it's like, I mean, we're going to talk about whether the movie's good or not, I guess, ostensibly, but I'm not sure how you can even tell. But like, nothing about it is good in the normal way, even when it is good. Like, it's not being good in a normal way. It's cliches and it's weird, goofy shit. Like, it's never being good the way you expect a movie to be good, even when it is being good. Like, everything is delivered weird. Everything is written weird. Everything is, you know, it's just very strange. It's a very, very strange film.
Yeah, no, the chief criticism that I have read of folks that really didn't care for the film, right, have to do with the lead actress's choices, right? And I think that is not to rebuke their criticism, because, you know, everybody's criticism, they're more than welcome to it, right? But, like, I think that is part of the weirdness that James Wan wanted, right? Like,
and like her decision, like her decisions are kind of off in their own box over here, right? Because there's information about how she behaves that is not rational, because she literally has a brain inside her brain and doesn't know it.
Right.
But like, meanwhile, everyone else is making like dumb horror movie decisions, though. Like, everyone walks into dark rooms. Everyone hears a scary noise and walks into a dark room without turning a light on. Every single person who has ever existed in this movie has never seen a completely pitch black room they didn't want to walk into, even when they knew a serial killer was happening.
Right.
And there was a light switch right there. There's no reason for them not to turn a light on, but they never do. Like, shit like that. And it's left, right, and sideways. But again, no one cares, because the movie does not spend 2 seconds on it.
Yeah.
The movie has already barreled past it into the next crazy shit that's about to happen.
Yeah. Typically the next crazy dark room that there's crazy. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like, the entire chase scene, at one point, I think it's Officer Lee is running after ostensibly Gabriel, but Gabriel as our lead character still. We don't know that yet. But I had to think to myself a billion times, like, maybe I'm just a coward. And that there is a very firm possibility of that. But even if I were a cop, I'd be like, whoa, this dude just scaled like a building, kind of, right? Like, he climbs down the fire escape in this building like, I don't know, like an animal of some kind. The minute he did that shit, I'd be out. I'd be like, I'm going to call this shit in to somebody that gets paid more, and there'll be more than just me that's going to chase this guy, you know, down into the sewers. Krusty Antiques mentioned that it did remind them, I'm going to say them because I don't know pronouns here, a basket case, which is another thing that I've heard quite a bit of.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, so we're gonna get into this later too a little bit, but like, a lot of people have been making comparisons to Basket Case because, again, of the twin stuff.
Right.
A lot of people have been, I mean, have mentioned The Dark Half, which literally has this plot. Like, I mean, you know, it's he had a twin in utero that he absorbed into his brain, and now it has displaced itself into physical reality as his alter ego. Like, I mean, it's less bonkers than this movie, because every movie is less bonkers than this movie. But I mean, like, plot wise, it's very similar. Like, as far as the explanation of what the phenomenon is.
Yeah. It did remind me of that. This movie somehow manages to be incredibly bonkers while not being satirical and taking, like, I still would hesitate saying that this movie takes itself really serious because it's not ostentatious, you know?
It doesn't take itself seriously, but it's straight faced.
Okay.
Like, it is never like, the characters in the movie are never in on the joke.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Like, they're as wide-eyed as we are, right? You know, like, they're like, what the fuck is going on?
And that's fundamentally how you keep a movie from becoming a parody of itself, right? Essentially, is that you make it never wink at the audience.
Yeah.
The movie never winks at you. It never tells you, hey, I'm just kidding around, which is partly why people are reacting to it so weirdly, right?
Yeah.
Because they're like, am I supposed to take this seriously? I can't tell.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and like, because it kind of exists in this weird middle ground, because there just aren't many films that are made like this. You right. either make a really serious horror film that A24 gobbles up and spits at, you know, whatever, right? And then maybe we talk about it on a special episode of the show or whatever. Or you kind of make these meta, almost satire, but not really. And those are great, right? Like I like Your Cabin in the Woods and You're Next. Right. I love those films, right? But this somehow operates in the middle ground between both of those types of movies. And it's, in at least in my mind, a really big breath of fresh air because we haven't seen anything like it in so long.
I mean, it's basically like, except that it's more ridiculous, but it's basically like direct-to-video horror, except that it's made with a polish that those movies rarely get.
Agreed, yeah.
In part because its budget's bigger, in part because James Wan knows how to stretch a budget. Like him or hate him, if there's one thing Wan knows how to do, it's make $20 million look like $50 million.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, because like every movie he's ever made, its budget is minuscule compared to what you think it is.
Yeah.
Except maybe like Aquaman and Furious 7 and those kind of, and in those cases, yeah. In those cases, you're operating in like studio stuff that who knows what's going on behind the scenes in something
yeah.
like that. But like,
yeah.
You know, the Conjuring movies, the Insidious movies, all those, like, their budgets are much smaller than they look like on screen. And the same is probably true here. But this movie looks like a blockbuster budget movie.
Yeah.
For all that, it's a fairly contained character piece until the end. But like, you know, it looks polished, it looks sharp, it looks glossy, again, to its detriment for some people. But you know, it looks expensive.
Yeah, like the special effects that create that melting reality scene look fantastic, and it's innovative and different. So then, when you couple that with like, oh yeah, you got a conjoined twin that's back and he's real pissed. You know, it's like
my favorite thing. Sorry, I'm going to interrupt.
No, you're good.
So my favorite thing about the whole conjoined twin Gabriel plot is that, like, on top of all that, right, like, that's ridiculous enough. You've got, you know, your conjoined twin that has rebuilt itself, and now it's using you to kill, right? That's already ridiculous. Also, by the way, we're going to mention this, and you just have to accept it, because we're going to spend a second on it, and then it's gone. Also, this twin that you have in the back of your brain has superhuman strength, and can control electricity.
Yeah, electricity. Why? I don't know.
Yeah.
Right.
They give literally the most passing possible explanation for that that is like humanly imaginable. It is what would be his comic book origin story if he were a comic book character, which he is.
Most definitely.
It's like so that you can summarize it in one sentence. They used electric shock to keep him sedate.
I didn't even pick up on that. Okay.
And he absorbed the electricity from the electric shock, and so now he can control electricity, just like that's how electricity works, 100%.
Right. Yeah, in that way, that part of the movie, and it didn't make my, like, my two movies that I would recommend that were in the similar vein, but I'm like, this is some Shocker-level shit right here, right?
100%,
like,
right? 100%, yeah.
Right, because not only can he control, like, electricity to, like, kill people or do whatever, right? But, like, the primary purpose for that ability is not really anything cool other than his ability to directly communicate to other people via cell phones, which when I was kind of jotting down notes about the movie, I think honestly is really an innovative way not to get him to talk to people because we've seen that before, but it's a really innovative way to deal with the, oh yeah, how are we going to do this movie in an age where we have cell phones? Like,
right.
well, motherfucker, your cell phone's not working. And if it is, then like he's texting you weird shit on it. So right. Yeah.
And it sets up the misdirect that it can't be her, because he talks while she's there.
So good, yeah.
You know, I mean, and it like, and it's an obvious misdirect. Like everything in this movie is obvious, except that like, I've seen people complain like, oh, I guessed the twist. Oh, blah blah blah. No, you didn't guess the twist. They literally tell you the twist in the first minute. What they don't tell you is how fucking insane they're going to go with it. Like just how completely, like how far they're going to crank it past anything reasonable.
Oh yeah. Like, yeah, I can envision this film where she's the serial killer and she just goes into this fugue state and like, right. Gabriel takes her over and starts stabbing people and you're like, oh, and that's scary or whatever. But the entire last 20 minutes of this, that is, you know, the elongated dance scene, coupled with the entire backwards movement of that thing is the bonkers part of that movie. I would also add, the fact that we have placed this in asylum in the scariest, wonkiest, most isolated portion, like it might as well have been put in a fucking lighthouse, you know?
I mean, like I called it, it's a gothic castle. Like yeah, that's what, in my review, like literally the first shot in this movie is a gothic castle that turns out to be an asylum.
Yeah.
Like no one, like only James Wan would get whatever kind of, would take the clout he got from the Conjuring movies and the money he got from the Aquaman movies and make something this ridiculous and silly and bonkers.
And what I love about this film is you have that, right? You have this beautiful shot of this like fucking creepy ass mansion out on the, you know, on the little peninsula of the wherever they're at, right? That is scary. And then we like completely abandon it for 90 minutes. And then, and I think here is where our discussion of Giallo really needs to happen. We get this great and kind of classic Giallo moment where the non-detective civilian investigator goes and discovers all of the secrets that then, you know, kind of unravel the rest of the movie. But after having spent, you know, a while doing all the research now, that kind of civilian detective element is a through line to a lot of Giallo films.
Yeah, absolutely. And so like, okay, so talking about Giallo in relation to this, because I made the argument that it's a Giallo film. And again, I laid out my reasons in the review, but again, We can say it is or we can say it isn't. There's all sorts of reasons why it is. There's all sorts of reasons why it isn't. And fundamentally, neither of them matter when you get right down to it. It's operating in a tradition that goes back to Giallo. That's undeniable.
Yeah.
And whether it is one or not is immaterial to that, which is the actual relevant thing. But like specifically, Argento's Giallos, which are what a lot of us come to the genre from. It's what you mentioned you came to the first place. Like Argento's Giallos are what most people who are horror fans now looking backward at Giallo, like that's what they think of. That's what they remember. That's usually what they're talking about. There are Giallo fans who get into like, you know, Sergio Martino and Fulci's handful and, you know, Bava's originals and blah, blah, blah. And honestly, Bava can go into this discussion too. Like Juan, less than operating in the Giallo mold specifically, Juan is referencing, like he's a big fan of Argento. He's a big fan of Bava and like all his lighting choices in all of his movies, in his lighting choices, in his camera choices, they're very inspired by Bava and Argento, who, you know, Bava inspired Argento, Argento inspired, you know, Juan. But like one of the things that comes up in Argento's Giallos, especially really heavily, and it's something I've picked up on and written about a number of times, is there's the civilian detective aspect, but there's also, and this gets mentioned in at least one of the articles we're going to link to in the show notes, there's the aspect where the civilian detective in question often already knows the solution but can't remember it.
Oh, yeah, right, yes.
And so it's a matter not of actually solving the crime in the normal way. It's a matter of looking for the piece that will unlock that memory for you.
I like it. I like it.
And so it becomes very internalized. It becomes very much about, just as the Giallo is very much about like compulsions and an internal sort of struggle that we don't understand, and people who seem normal and are actually killers and blah, blah. It's also very much about like the inconsistency of memory, the unreliability of our own knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that ties into, you know, like the jealous connection to the Weird Tale, the jealous connection to the broader, you know, fantastique tradition and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that is that, there are so many things that I'm going to link to here in the show notes. We are not going to get to all of them,
oh, yeah.
But there is just some fantastic, I think, literature out there that has been written about giallo. And the one that you mentioned here, I specifically wanted to give a shout out to. It's from The Philosophy of Composition, maybe originally, but it's by Michelle Delville. And it's the title of the article is very long, and here it comes. On the giallo considered as one of the fine arts with attendant considerations of the Weird Tale, the Dark Grotesque, and other Argento's films. So the long and the short of her thesis here is that all of those kind of subgenres are linked and linked through some of those qualities that you talked about. And I think both of us have an affinity for the kind of Weird Tale in general. So I love the idea that this kind of fluidity of memory is important to both of those. And like James Wan goes full in on that idea, you know, right. Like we're going to bury the memory of your twin literally in your brain, right. You know?
Like, oh yeah. There's a moment in the movie where like by this point, both me and the person I went to the theater with were like, had to figure out what was going on. But she says like, there's something there. It's in the back of my head. Right. And you know, that's a phrase we all use, right? Like I'm trying to think of something. I can't remember it. It's right there. It's in the back of my head, but I can't think of it. But in this case, literally, it is literally in the back of her head. There's like a face there in the back of her head.
Right. It comes down and says hi. Right. Yeah.
And so like, yeah, it's so literal. It takes what is normally figurative and makes it so idiotically literal. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there, you tell me, one of the more interesting aspects of giallo scholarly stuff that I had read was the focus on the eyes as both a filmic representation, right? Like as a device that the movies use. They focus up on the eyes specific of the people. I don't know if Malignant necessarily does that, but I really liked the idea. One of those articles that we'll link to here made a discussion about like the Panopticon. Are you remotely familiar with Jeremy Bentham's ideas on the Panopticon and all that jazz? Yep. So Foucault extends that idea to be like the kind of panoptic eye, that there's always like the government or the power structure, I should say, which isn't necessarily the government, that is always watching, right? Mm-hmm. And I love the idea that we have lots of those kind of eyeballs in Malignant, right? We have doctors, right? The medical industry. And honestly, if there is any kind of troubling thing about this movie, it's that like right now, I feel like probably is not the time to paint doctors as the villains, right? In anything. And then right. I was like, oh, you know, that sucks. But also I kind of get it. Somebody's got to be the bad guy. But I love that the police force is there, like literally acting as another set of eyes. And at the end of the day, her conjoined twin is named Gabriel, is very much a dude, right? And literally keeps eyes on her like the entire time, right? He is the literal eyes in the back of her head. And I love the idea that she is observed at all times by all kinds of different power structures, including her abusive husband, who like won't let her, you know, actualize any of her own dreams or any of her own ideas, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know. It was super obvious, I think, after reading that article and then coming back to visit it. You tell me, is that kind of eyeball shot really apparent in a lot of older giallo?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of eyeball stuff in giallo for a number of reasons. I mean, one thing, giallos love eye trauma. So there's lots of eyes getting stabbed in Giallo and adjacent films.
Okay.
We've talked about Zombie before. I mean, there's the famous eyeball scene in Zombie. That's a very Italian in that era scene. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But also there's a lot of shots of like the killer's eyes or people's eyes when they're scared or whatever. And part of that is because the Giallo, like the slasher film and like the films that inspired both of them, is very much about voyeurism. It's very much about specifically the voyeurism that you are engaged in as you watch the movie, right?
Like, oh, yeah.
It's about reminding you that you are watching people do bad things and enjoying that.
Right? Okay, I mean, I like that, like, yeah.
Like, the earliest, so the kind of, I don't know, the accepted wisdom, right, is that the Giallo begat the slasher.
Okay, sure. I think that's an easy transition. Okay. Right?
Whether that's true or not, whether that's oversimplification or not, but that's the kind of accepted wisdom, right? The slasher film grew out of the Giallo. And the movies that predated both of them are movies like Psycho and Peeping Tom.
Yep.
Which are like, there's a line in Scream, because Scream is kind of the movie that made us talk about movies the way we do now, which is to like codify them and try and render their formulas into rules,
sure,
which they never follow. Like, like they weren't rules; they were just formula. They were things that happened to recur, partly because they were easy to do, or partly because the previous one had made money, or whatever reason. They weren't rules when they were happening. But anyway, it points out at one point that it claims that Peeping Tom is the first slasher film because it's the first movie to have a killer point of view shot.
Okay.
But all these movies like are very much about putting you in the shoes of the killer, making you complicit in the acts that you're watching.
Hmm.
Whether they do that well or not, they're all, you know, all of them do deal with that to some extent.
Yeah.
Or lots of them do anyway. I mean, there's I want to say Torso, one of Sergio Martino's giallos. Like, it opens with this like menage a trois, I believe, and there's a camera shutter clicking as it's happening, and so as it pans out, you know, you're looking through the camera shutter, like it makes, ooh, it very, you know, it makes it very explicit that you are complicit in,
yeah
you are complicit in observing, possibly with the party's knowledge, this thing that you should not be observing, right?
Like, ah,
you know, and so That I think is a big part of why like the eye motif comes up so often, is because it's an easy way to get that voyeurism angle.
That's fascinating. I also think like, but Malignant works really hard to deal with that idea of complicity, right? And at least to have a discussion about it, because it almost inverts that idea, because like it works really hard to make sure that our main character isn't complicit, right? Like, we get this really brilliant scene of Gabriel in the prison cell, who just beats up every like female criminal from 1985 to 19 like 97. Like,
oh my god, the people in that jail cell. Oh my god.
It's like the Village People, right? Just right. In, you know, just
there is full on like a blaxploitation character.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In
yeah.
that jail cell. Like she is from the 70s.
But I love that. Like, Gabriel totally waxes all of them, right? And then we get like maybe 10 minutes later, as they're kind of revealing or doing whatever they're doing, we just see her sitting pleasantly in the cell, you know, and like that is how she is. So it removes some of that, I don't know, some of that agency for sure. But right. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You were talking about the Panopticon and about her being observed and Gabriel, like her abusive husband is just Gabriel again.
Yes, right? Of course.
Gabriel is already this abusive partner. He doesn't want her to have other connections. And ultimately, you know, the horrible thing we learn at the end, which again, you can probably see coming, is that he's been explicitly keeping her from realizing one of her dreams by literally eating her unborn children.
Yes.
To give himself form.
It's
I mean, and that's like without her knowledge, and in a way that makes it seem like she's at fault, right? He's been doing this and gaslighting her,
yes,
all this time, you know, and I mean, it's he is another abusive partner that she can escape from because he literally lives inside her head, which is a compelling parallel. Again, not to suggest that this movie is anything but stupid, because this movie is incredibly stupid.
Yeah,
but, right. But like, it's an interesting parallel between like what people who have, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder and people who've been abused deal with, which is essentially having a voice inside our heads that is our abuser, again, that goes with us even when we leave and tells us all the horrible things our abuser said to us and says, you know, you're not worth it, you're bad, you deserve this. And, you know, we have to go through therapy and all that stuff to learn how to do what she does at the end, essentially, which is lock that voice up and not listen to it.
Yeah. No, I think you're 100% right. That is, at first in that discussion of that, when I first watched it, I was like, man, I don't know if I love the subtext that the, you know, like the abuser is coming from within the house. But I think in the context of like dealing with the cyclical nature of all of that, I think the movie, I think it makes sense. And I think it's certainly less icky than I thought it was initially, at least in that small context, obviously.
I mean,
Again,
this is an incredibly stupid movie.
Yes.
And
yes.
and it supports a lot of readings because it's not really interested in supporting readings.
Yeah.
Which means that it doesn't give you a ton to work with, so you can do a lot yourself.
Yes.
Like I can go up with that reading, but I can also just as easily come with a come up with a reading that, for example, suggests that it is critical of abortion rights.
Sure. Oh yeah. Oh,
100%. I don't think it is, because I don't think James Wan is interested in that. I think he's just interested in crazy monster running around backward, killing a bunch of people.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I could, with a little bit of time, and certainly we don't have it now, but I linked to an article here. There is a very clear link between the Yellow Vest protest movement in France and Giallo pictures in general, right? There are some clear linkage. In fact, the Italian version of those, or at least according to this article that is here, that was called La June Giallo, which means the Yellow Vest. And a couple of interesting kind of connections between all of that, between power and counter power and all that kind of jazz. But you're 100% right. Like, I was able to put so much in. Sometimes it's a little tricky to find great academic literature on stuff. I know that's going to blow your mind that, you know, like maybe what the Monster Club or whatever just doesn't have a ton of really great critical literature about it. But I found a ton, maybe not specific to Malignant, but definitely specific to Giallos, mostly because like you can. Malignant is so big and large and silly and dumb. Then it's like, yeah, shit, let's talk about how conjoined twins are a real phenomenon or whatever. Yeah, like you could do whatever.
And like Giallo, like Giallos, like the plot is largely secondary in a Giallo, right? Like it's about style and presentation and atmosphere, which is something that the article we talked about earlier uses to connect to the Weird Tale, which like Lovecraft's definition of the Weird Tale is that it has more than the tropes of horror fiction. It has this atmosphere. And you know, Giallos are all about atmosphere. And Jolly, rather. You know, it's like plot is often largely secondary, but at the same time, they're very symbolic, or seem to be. They're very concerned with imagery and potential symbols, which leaves room for interpretation. Yeah. Which leaves room for lots and lots of articles to be written. Like, yeah, the Giallo might be the most, like, written about subgenre of.
Yeah. It was super fun to do the research this week. You know, like I was like, oh, wow. And I think in our Slack, I was like, you know, I had no idea this connection. You know, we did a lot of that this week, which was as much fun for me as the actual conversation. Like, I'm a nerd at heart, so I love to read all that shit. And I would encourage, if there are any listeners out there that don't regularly take a look at the show notes, this would be the week to do it, because
there's a ton of stuff in the show notes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I may or may not have gone a little overboard. All right. So we are running a little bit behind time. So let's before we get to our four films, you have a pitch for our sequel. What is it?
Okay, so my pitch for the sequel is essentially that Nick Fury shows up, right? Like,
of course.
There's no way. There is no way that this movie ends the way it implies that it ends, which is that everything's fine now.
Right.
Because even if we assume that someone accepts the argument that you didn't kill all those people, your conjoined twin that lives in the back of your brain did, no one is going to accept the justification that, no, it's fine, I've got him under control now. You killed like 100 people.
Right.
And so like my pitch is basically like the government or someone steps in and says, okay, we know what you are. We know what Gabriel is capable of, because Gabriel is a superhero. And right. She implies that she has all his powers now at the end. She has his superhuman strength. Presumably that means she also has his ability to control electricity. So the government steps in and they're like, okay, here's the deal. You do black bag work for us, essentially. And we don't put you in a prison or kill you.
Okay.
Because I mean, what else are you going to do with someone who like has a split personality, one of which is a serial killer and both of them have superpowers? You can put them in a box or you can kill them. You cannot trust, oh, it's going to be fine. It's fine now. Don't worry. I've got it under control. Like, that's not a reasonable course of action. So yeah, they make her a one person suicide squad.
I love it. I would give my money freely.
Okay, and so interestingly, and I want to mention this before we wrap up, in 2011, James Wan was credited as the story writer. He did not write the script. He wrote just the story for a four-issue, I think, comic book series. Came out from Boom Studios that was called Malignant Man. What? And it basically had this movie's plot.
No.
It was about a guy who had what turned out to have been a parasitic twin that gave him superpowers.
Oh. So he's just been sitting on this shit.
Apparently. Yeah. I have not read it yet, but I'm gonna get a hold of it and I'll report back.
I'll put the link to anybody else that wants to buy a copy in the show notes. Interesting. I like it. All right, so we gotta do these last two parts quick here, Oren. So what two movies did you say were good films to go along beside this one?
So my first pick was The Dark Half, because of the reasons we were talking
about. Of course, absolutely.
My second pick was going to be The Eyes of Laura Mars, because it has the same, like, I'm seeing the visions of what Serial Killer is doing, blah, blah, blah. But it's actually way too, like, upstanding a movie to go along with this one. It's too actually good. So I went ahead and picked Dead Silence instead, which is James Wan's only other movie that is this bonkers. And man, is it ever.
Very good. So I picked Upgrade, which I think very much has at least some of the same central conceit, which is like something else living inside of your brain that makes you do shit. It's also got wickedly wild fight scenes in it, which if you haven't seen Upgrade, it's Lee Whannell who did The Invisible Man. It's fantastic. It's very, very good. Great. I wouldn't necessarily call it horror, but definitely like action horror.
It's definitely horror adjacent. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then M. Night Shyamalan's Split, which I think obviously is tapping into that same kind of different personality thing, but it's got an equally bonkers ending to it.
Right. And it's also presuming that, you know, basically your monster is a superhero.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not even a spoiler because there's another movie where that premise, right? Like they made a third movie. So.
Well, and in the final 20 minutes of Split, again, I saw it with my wife who doesn't necessarily love horror movies, but she really enjoyed this one because it's like, are they really going to do what I think they're going to do? And then they do it and you're like, what the fuck? And like that kind of feeling is how you spend the last 20 minutes of Malignant too. So yeah. Yeah. Okay. So IndieWire has... I have our more traditional Letterboxd user review that I'll put down here in the show notes. But give us our one-star review from IndieWire. Go for it, Oren.
Yes. A dry seriousness haunts Malignant more than any murderous ghoul. Someone shared this on Twitter, just the screen cap that I sent you. And so I went and read the article, and yep, they 100% double down on this. They're like, yeah, this movie's way too, like, staid and serious, and, like, it needs to just cut loose a little bit. So obviously words don't mean anything anymore. Like, words just don't have meanings at all now, near as I can tell.
And listen, I love for the most part, IndieWire. They do great shit. They're often very good about trying to reach out and to elevate some of the smaller magazines like Signal Horizon. But yikes, I don't want to like ever tell somebody that their take is wrong. Maybe their take is wrong on this one.
No, but so from now on, when something's really, really just completely bonkers out of left field, I'm going to call it dry seriousness.
It's too dry serious.
That's going to be my code word now for when something's just too stupid and ridiculous. Yeah.
There's too much dry seriousness in this film. I love it. Oren, where can they find more of your stuff on the internet?
I am, as always, I am Oren Gray at Facebook and Twitter and Letterboxd and Instagram and all those places. And at orengray.com, where you can read me rambling about these Crestwood House monster books.
Oh, man, I'm stoked.
Halloween.
Yeah, that's great. You can find more of my stuff at Ty Unsel, where I tweet about politics and education and sometimes horror and all of the three wrapped up together. I also am the guy that controls the day-to-day there at Signal Horizon. So we are on TikTok now because everyone feels the need to be on TikTok. So go check out the shit that we're producing there. I can't say there's a lot of dancing, but there is a lot of horror talk. So it's a work in progress, as in all things. So, yeah. Oren, speaking of works in progress, what are we watching next time?
We're going to go ahead and watch Dead Silence because, again, we couldn't get enough of James Wan being completely bonkers, and you apparently haven't seen it before.
I haven't.
I'm very excited about this because, oof, yeah, it is an R-rated Goosebumps movie. It is quite a thing.
Oh, that's so great. Well, we have lots of stuff, very exciting stuff planned in October. So we appreciate you coming and watching and listening. And if you ever have any questions or concerns about what we're talking about here, if you want to pitch me an article or you just want to pick my brain, this is a true story. I got a wonderful email from an Australian academic that had listened to our episode about Dark City and psychogeography, and like it was fascinating, and I'd love to hear that kind of stuff. So yeah, send that stuff to us because we love to hear when we're doing good or bad. We just love to hear about ourselves because that's the way we are.
Because we're on the internet, and that's what the internet is for.
Yes, absolutely. And I can always blame my conjoined twin that lives in the back of my head. Right. So don't blame me.
I actually thought that's where you were going with that when you were like, this is a true story. If you want to pick my brain, there's another person back there.
Yeah. Oh, that's good stuff. Christ. Hey, go watch Malignant again. The new film. And come join us next time where we're going to chat all kinds of good stuff about it. And until then, class dismissed. Have a great weekend.